Well, it's a real pleasure to be with you this afternoon at the inaugural Young Producers Symposium. I was excited when this idea came to our board, and I suppose that excitement bled over to an invitation to speak. So be careful what you wish for, right? Now, serious note, I am glad to be here. I'm also glad to see that there are many of you that identify yourselves as young that might be a bit older than me. So that helps me. I'm kind of, you know, middle-aged now, and my kids make me feel a little older than what I think I am, but you're helping my perception of self, so I appreciate that as well. My goal, actually, in the discussion today is not to... hopefully I don't bore you to death, but my goal is not to spend too much time on sort of the nuts and bolts of genomics and DNA technology, but maybe to step back a little bit and think about why and how we should use the information. Ultimately, you'll have lots of opportunities throughout the next several days to learn lots about the nuts and bolts of the genetic improvement tools we have available through a variety of the general session and certainly in the afternoon symposia and decision or committee structure meetings. So I want to spend a little time and think about maybe some of our philosophy and things that we ought to think about in terms of genetic improvement, because at the end of the day, in our beef production system and the beef value chain, genetics are really only one part of what we have control over. And certainly we have to think about how we use genetics and make selection change in a context of our own production environment. So things that we might experience in northeast Kansas and that production environment, I know from experience, is a lot different than John's place in western Colorado. So thinking through selection in the context of environment and how those things work together with our management and manifest themselves into phenotypes that ultimately move into the value chain are really important. And they're also really complex, and we have to be very very careful in how we approach selection, but we should be bold, and we should adopt new technology, and we should be motivated to learn more about genetics and that interaction. So I'm really pleased there's lots of young folks here at BIF this year. I know how important BIF has been to me over time, and so I'm glad to give back to the organization in a number of roles. But early on, I worked for a breed association in Colorado right out of college, and one of the single best sources of information and knowledge and most certainly networking and relationship building was the annual BIF meeting. Twig, I was at the meeting in 95 in Wyoming, and so got to see firsthand from the side of the ring all the discussion, and actually was one of the experiences that really encouraged me to go to more BIF meetings. So we're hopeful you have a great week and learn lots, and most importantly, get to know each other. You guys, if you continue to come to BIF, you'll make a network of friends that you see every year and hopefully interact with in between events to help build your knowledge and experience. So what is our goal in beef cattle selection? Our goal really is to make the best possible decisions for our operation and likely our customers if we're seed stock producers. We want to optimize our gains via selection, so making good use of technology and resources to support that selection. We also need to think about it in the context of risk management or risk abatement. How do we avoid making a really bad decision? Okay, so our tools lend themselves well to both of those things. And certainly if you're a seed stock producer, and I suspect many of you are, you'll likely want to be able in a position to provide good information to your customers, right, and document what it is that you have to sell. Okay, that's part of market differentiation and engagement in the marketplace. And if many of you have followed bull sale prices this year, we're at sort of record high sale prices for not only seed stock genetics, but certainly animals clear through the value chain. And with that change in price, my sense is, as I work with lots of producers in Kansas, is the expectation has changed, right? We're not selling, you know, Chevrolets anymore. We're selling Cadillacs. And the expectation of performance and documentation and information about that product has been accentuated. And so as a seed stock producer, to remain competitive in the marketplace, doing a better job documenting the genetics of your animals that you have for sale becomes an important concept and an important tool. So one of the questions I get asked a lot is, should I use genomics? A producer asked me, should I use genomics? My response typically in a little bit to engage the audience a little more is yes, right? I used to be I'm fairly conservative and maybe not as big a proponent in the past on genomics technology as I am today. And the reason for that is 5 or 10 years ago, the tools didn't work very well. They were very interesting from an academic or scientific perspective, but in terms of utility to our producers, fairly marginal. That's changed in the last 2 or 3 years dramatically, to the extent now that broad scale and wide adoption of the technology is merited in the seed stock sector particularly, but there are certainly applications for commercial producers as well. Some of those applications and the way you should consume some of this information is if you're a commercial producer or as you interact with your customers that are commercial producers, largely the mechanism for delivery of this information is in a tool that they already know how to use, and that's EPDs. Okay, so making sure we provide a conduit of methodology and information flow in our business that moves that genomic data into national cattle evaluation so it spits out genomically enhanced EPDs versus many of you probably remember 5 or 6 years ago we had 2 pieces of information that led to a lot of confusion, a lot of distrust of both pieces of information. And that's been a big challenge and one BIF's actually been very instrumental in helping surmount and provide guidance to our partners in the system to merge that information, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. In certain circumstances, using genomic tools for selection of replacement heifers can be useful, whether that's potentially a molecular breeding value for a variety of maternal traits, or something simple as parentage identification, being able to discern in your calf crop which females are out of bulls that you've identified as ones to keep replacements out of. Okay, so a really sort of low-cost, low-tech application of DNA technologies, but one for many of us could be very effective in sorting out and being more discreet and precise in our replacement female selection by picking bulls out of those maybe AI sires that we've used that we know have a good likelihood of producing high-quality replacement heifers. Certainly, if you're a seed stock producer, there's multiple sort of places for engagement. One of the most common ones, and I think maybe one of the ones that has the least impact, is actually genotyping bulls in our sale offering. Many of you may raise your eyebrows at that, but one of the challenges we have in production is it's important to document our product, no doubt. But think about from a genetic improvement standpoint for our own herd, we invest say $80 a bull to genotype them, where do those bulls go? They go off and breed cows at one of our customers' places, right? How do we leverage that information, that genotype information then in our own herd to make improvement? Okay, those genetics have walked off the farm, okay? Maybe a better spot to start for many of us is actually genotyping replacement female candidates, right? Those are females that are going to make a lasting impression and influence in our population of cows that we're going to produce bulls out of for the next, you know, 5 to 8 years. Maybe doing a better job there provides a better opportunity for return on investment. Does that make sense to everybody? I think sometimes we get caught up in what I call marker-assisted marketing, right? So that's using DNA technology to sell bulls, which is important, but ultimately not what we're really out to do, right? We're out to make genetic improvement in our herd, and so being able to capture that information and use it in our system is a really important concept. And until we do that, it's marketing, okay? If we only genotype the front 5 bulls in our sale catalog offering, that's marketing, okay? Don't confuse that with selection, different strategy. A little bit of my soapbox talk, okay? This is a slide that one of my colleagues a while ago put together, Jerry Taylor, and I think it does a really nice job of sort of describing not only DNA technology in the beef business, but as you think about it, lots of other things can get applied to this. And this is called the Gartner Hype Cycle. And it really talks about sort of how we get enthused and how we adopt technology in our particular case. And on the bottom left here is some technology trigger. And for our example, we'll use genomic tools in the beef industry as the trigger. If we think back to the late 1990s, many of you in the audience were probably in high school then or maybe in elementary school. Lots of enthusiasm about genomics and DNA technology and the silver bullet that it represented. Unfortunately, we ascended on this peak of inflated expectations, not understanding what we had at hand in terms of a model of our view was there was likely a few genes that had huge effect in our production system, and we were going to be able to leverage those across breeds in a really simple and easy-to-use tool. Is that true or false? It's as false as you can make it, okay? The system is much more complex than that. And so once we realized that, we went through the trough of disillusionment, okay? That's a period of time that, at least in my sort of mental history, encompassed the early 2000s and maybe through 2005 or 6, where we had realization that we're going to need much more sophisticated tools. Some of those tools are now commonplace in our system, things like the 50K SNP chip panel, sequencing information, all those sort of things that we sort of take for granted today were a result of our living in this trough of disillusionment as academics for a period of time, and certainly as producers tried to engage that technology. Through the slope of enlightenment, then, is sort of the next phase, and that's the spot where we're actually, I think, just we're transitioning from enlightenment to application. And so the plateau of productivity is a spot where the technology becomes widely adopted, widely utilized across the producers, and that's a spot we're getting. If we look at consumption of those products by seed stock and commercial producers, certainly the last year or two has been very encouraging in terms of the rate of adoption of that technology. And part of the reason adoption is happening is because the tool works. Okay? Is it perfect? Probably not. Is there room for improvement? Most definitely. But can we capitalize on that information and use it to make better decisions? Absolutely. To the point of making better decisions, I think sometimes it's important to really illustrate what our goal is. And hopefully this picture captures some of that. If we think about our mating systems, when we produce, on paper anyway, a mating decision to produce a particular calf, so we've got a sire in mind and a cow in mind, when we put those together, we calculate what's called a pedigree estimate EPD, which is simply, as you know, the average of the two parents. Okay, so hypothetically, if we could mate that bull and cow together several thousand times, the calves' mean genetic performance or genetic merit, if we knew it perfectly, would be exactly in the middle. Okay, but what do we know about matings? Okay, are all the calves born to a particular pairing average? No, in fact, almost none of them are exactly average, right? They have a tendency to be close to the middle, but certainly there's, because of the mechanisms and the biology, there's randomness and variation induced into our genetic streams. And so our goal then is to figure out, as quickly as we can, some estimate of an animal's true progeny difference or true level of genetic merit. Okay, and we academics call that difference between the true progeny difference and parent average, Mendelian sampling, just recognizing that variation that's been induced. Okay, so how do we get from a little bit of information to a whole bunch of information? What mechanisms do we use? Well, historically, we've done things like progeny testing, performance data collection, going out in the field, collecting calving ease scores, birth weights, weaning weights, carcass data, ultrasound data. For traits like reproduction, what do? We breed heifers. We monitor lifetime productivity of cows. What are the principal costs of those strategies? Well, it turns out there are really two things, time and money, right? Think about stayability or lifetime productivity of a cow. By the time we have good data, right, the bull's 8 or 9 years old, is most certainly starting to drift off the back ends of lots of pedigrees, okay? That kind of information, very valuable to us, very valuable to our commercial producers, really hard to leverage, okay? And that's where genomics comes in, right? It allows us to gather information to point us towards an animal's true level of genetic merit for a number of traits, particularly these very hard to measure or costly traits, much earlier in life, okay? So it's a shortcut in many ways to provide information into our genetic evaluation system to get a better estimate. Okay, we have lots of different tools that let us do that. I think one of the things that's really a challenge now is keeping up with all the different products that are available, which is actually a good thing, right? We used to almost exclusively talk about a DNA marker panel called 50K that had 50,000 individual markers on it, okay? We actually don't, that's kind of the currency that we talk about, but we actually don't ever genotype any animals on that old platform anymore. It becomes a byproduct, really, of a strategy called imputation that we'll talk about in just a minute. But the panels that we use today are represented. This is a slide I stole from Dorian Garrick. The big blue circle here represents a really high-density 770K panel, one that doesn't get used very much outside of research circles because of the cost. The smaller green circle here represents about a 77K product. This one happens to be from GeneSeq called GGPHD. The black one here represents 50K. And then the small orange one is a low-density panel called GGPLD. And there's a variety of other companies and products out there that sort of span this gamut of low-cost, low-density panels to high-density, high-cost panels. Okay, and they've been designed, in fact, I see Stuart's over here, they've been designed to actually overlap some to allow us to translate or impute genotypes either up or down to a common density. And that becomes actually a very important feature of many of these products that allow continuity or usefulness of information beyond maybe an individual animal's own productive life. I'm not sure what happened on this slide. Oh, there it goes. This is one I stole from Matt Spangler, and it describes, I'll go back one, imputation. And let's say we have a high-density genotype on an individual sire, and that's represented here. This is not sequence data. It's just SNPs on the chip that describe in order the SNP markers. And then we know down here we've produced a calf that's out of this particular sire. And because we know what the offspring's genotype is on a low-density panel, here represented by the G and the A, the low-density panel doesn't include the markers in between these two spots. But since we know the sire of that particular calf, and we can test that actually, we can go in the imputed genotype and fill in the missing information. Okay, so we just go say, okay, we've got some landmark information that tells us where we're at. These happen to coincide with what was in the sire's pedigree and genotype. So we just fill in the gaps. Okay, does everybody get that? It's sort of just filling in the holes based on some other information that we have. It's imputation. Okay. There are a variety of those panels out, and a lot of them have been tested now for their utility in producing useful genomic information. And this slide just illustrates the concordance between genetic predictions or genomic measurements done using actual genotype data from a panel like 50K versus taking the low-density stuff off of that and repredicting via imputation that 50K genotype and then calculating the MBVs, and you'll notice they're almost perfect alignment in that resulting set of correlations. And the reason for that is we've just filled in the gaps and rerun the stuff, okay? So it provides lots of utility. Well, why might we use that? Well, the principal driver is cost, right? If we can get almost all the information out using a lower cost product, that seems like a pretty tractable road to go down. Okay. One of the things I want to talk about, so we've talked a little bit about some of the products and the tools, is maybe a little more about what impact we can expect long-term in terms of these tools. Okay. And hopefully that motivates us to think about useful and novel ways to adopt the technology. To me, the most important attribute or contribution of these genomic tools to our selection system is actually the increase in accuracy we observe in the EPDs of the animals that have been tested. Okay, and that's a little subtle, right? I think sometimes our producers think, well, we're going to genotype them and their EPDs are going to get better. Well, that's not true, right? Half of them get better. Half of them get worse, right? So we're getting better information. We're getting more information to refine our estimate of genetic merit. But statistically, we expect as we add information, half of them to go up and half of them to go down, okay? Which I know is a downer, right? But the important part to recognize, though, is that the accuracy on all of them goes up, regardless of which direction their EPD goes. And the EPD is adjusted to reflect that new information that's been included. So accuracy is the principal benefit to us as producers as we use genomic technology. Okay, that allocation of benefit is disproportional across animals of different classifications in our production system. Low accuracy or young animals that don't have any progeny data get the biggest influence or the biggest boost in accuracy. You can think about a high accuracy AI bull that, say, has a weaning weight EPD accuracy of 0.96. Okay. That means there's lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of performance data on that bull from many different production environments, okay? So it makes sense that if we add a little bit of information to a big pile of information, do we get much new information? Almost none, right? So accuracy doesn't change. So the benefit actually comes to animals that, for us as producers, need the most help, right? They're those low accuracy animals, and that's where we observe the benefit. The other sort of corollary to this is that we think about multiple trait selection, or we should think about multiple trait selection every day, right? There's more than one trait that contributes to profitability in beef production. And our challenge sometimes is figuring out what those traits are. So things like selection indexes have been developed to help us balance those traits out. They benefit, the accuracy of those indexes benefit by having better or higher quality, more accurate EPDs going into them, okay? And so the selection, multiple trait selection benefits from this improved accuracy as well. Well, why is accuracy important? Accuracy is important because it's a measure of not only information included, but can be perceived as a measurement of risk, okay? So a piece of data that's in the front of every major beef breed sire summary that almost nobody ever pays any attention to is a table called possible change, and it shows the linear relationship between increase in accuracy, okay, where we go from 0 to 1, so little information to nearly perfect information. And what we see is this linear decrease in possible change value. So for a trait like calving ease, this is from the Simmental evaluation, possible change of 7.8, 7, 6.2. And what these represent are values to create confidence intervals around an EPD to give you a measure of risk or where the true EPD might lie. Okay, so if we take, here's an example of two different bulls with different accuracies and resulting standard errors or possible change values. We'll focus for a second here on the red bull. It may be hard to see in the back, but there's little vertical drops or lines in these two distributions. This first one, these are represents, say, two bulls that have a weaning weight EPD of 40. This second red line here represents then the EPD plus the standard error of 11 or possible change value of 11.4, okay? Likewise, the second red line here to the left represents the EPD minus that possible change. The interpretation of that then is that with two-thirds confidence, that and we add more information to our EPDs, or our selection system, with two-thirds confidence that animal's true progeny difference lies in that interval, in this case from roughly about 29 to 51, okay? If you want 95% confidence of the interval where that true progeny value lies, you double the possible change. So it's somewhere between roughly about a 16 or 17 and 64, okay? That's a pretty big interval, right? Well, what happens when we add information? Well, as we add information, accuracy goes up, the expected possible change goes down. If we look at this bull in blue, he has an accuracy of 0.8. Now those intervals are much tighter, okay? It's plus or minus 3. So we have lots more confidence of where this particular blue bull's true progeny difference lies relative to the red bull, okay? The red bull is representative of what? Typical yearling bulls that our customers buy, okay? So having some idea of relative risk of where animals' EPDs might change become important, okay? Maybe not so important on weaning weight, right? That affects pay weight down the road. What if this was calving ease, okay? Plus or minus 7 for a low-accuracy bull, okay? If you're mating heifers to a yearling bull and you say, well, we're going to use a bull with a cutoff of 8, which is typical recommendation on an Angus scale, okay? Well, with 2/3 confidence, he's somewhere between a 1 and a 15, okay? What happens if he's a 1? We're up a lot at night, right? Okay, if he's a 15, we're golden. If he's a 1, we're in trouble, okay? So these accuracy and possible change values give us a nice measurement of risk. The other thing to think about is accuracy is a determination of our ability to make genetic progress, okay? And this makes sense. If we have a tool that gives us a more precise estimate of an animal's genetic merit, we make more reliable decisions. We can make more reliable progress moving forward, okay? If we have a piece of information that potentially is wrong and we make a decision based on that, that decreases our ability to make progress. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay? So what I just said in words is described in the breeder's equation, right? It's accuracy of the prediction, the intensity of our selection, how much variation there is in the population, divided by generation interval, tells us how much genetic change we can expect per year from selection. Okay? It's the limiting factor. Okay? If we have perfectly accurate predictions, we can make a lot more progress than if we have inaccurate predictions. Okay? Genomic technology helps us build accuracy again. So it's kind of the motivator here for the use of these tools. One of the challenges we have in our system is that the marker panels don't describe all of the genetic variation in any particular trait. Okay, right now, most of the marker panels are somewhere between 1/3 and 1/2 of the genetic variation in the trait. Okay, and this is a picture of one of those. Okay, the white circle represents the genetic variation in a trait. The black part represents the environmental variation. So combined, the outside circle here is phenotypic variation. This marker panel then only accounts for 1/3 of this, or 12%. Of the total, okay? So we have to be really careful in how much expectation we put in to describing variation, right? If we use a panel like this, it's only describing a portion of phenotypic variation. Our goal, though, is to get to something like this, okay, where we describe 80% of the genetic variation. So that roughly has a correlation of the animal's genotype to phenotype of about 0.9. So it does a much better job soaking up that information relative to genetic variation or additive variation. I want to illustrate real quickly, again, this idea of where the benefit comes, because for beef producers, this is really, really important. The bottom scale here represents EPD accuracy from 0 to 1. The black portion represents information from legacy source of an animal's own performance record as we move across to higher accuracy progeny and grand progeny information, okay? So if we add genomic data to our system, what we find is that these animals of low accuracy, the light gray bar then here represents the additional accuracy we get from adding the genomic information to our national cattle evaluation system. So we can take pedigree estimate animals up to nearly what they would be with a typical performance record. Animals with genotype and performance even get a little more boost. So they're really useful in building accuracy in our target population, the ones that we're at most risk for in terms of making a bad selection decision. So to reiterate, this importance is that we drive the molecular data into our national cattle evaluation systems to produce, and what you should consume then, are genomically enhanced EPDs, okay? I wish I had $5 for every time I got a question from a producer wanting to have the MBVs on some particular bull, okay? Why is that a risk? Why should you not use MBV data directly? Okay, it's because of the part-whole relationship between the animal's marked information, what we have genotyped, and the net effect of all the rest of the genes that affect the trait. Okay, that's this idea of two different pieces of information that are related, but consumed independently presents a lot of risk. Okay, in that an animal could have a really good genotype or molecular breeding value for the portions of the genome that are associated with the trait, those might all be favorable. But if the animal happens to be terrible in the rest of the genome for those particular traits, and we only use the molecular data, we make a really bad decision. Okay? So using something that represents the aggregate or both pieces of information helps us make much better decisions. And as producers, that's our goal, right? We want to make good decisions. We want to make selection progress, but we want to do it in a reliable way. And so the genomics tools really help us do that. I'm hopeful this has kind of given you a little bit of the 30,000-foot view, because over the next 2 days, you'll get lots of the minutiae. Okay? So I left out lots of details. But those details are something you can pick up in lots of the sessions, and certainly you'll get the names and faces of people identified that can help answer lots of those questions for you. So with that, I'm glad to quit. Maybe time for one question. I'll be around through the whole conference, part of the weekend. Do not hesitate if you have questions to corner me up, okay?